Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, we'll hear from Black Wyomingites who've been protesting around our state in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd.
When I sat there and watched the video of George Floyd being killed, that hurt me. Because what are they going to tell my son when his dad doesn't come home?
We will also bring you a story exploring some of the opposition to the movement.
They wanted a peaceful protest, and to me, a peaceful protest is them staying on the sidewalk, staying out on the street.
I'll also visit with State Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris, who will discuss where we are with COVID-19 and where she hopes to be.
I do have high hopes that we can open the schools. That is one thing that the new orders did.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter!
That's the sound of demonstrators in Laramie protesting racism and police brutality. Laramie is among hundreds of American cities where people have taken to the streets to demand change after George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. But Floyd's death also sparked unrest in parts of Wyoming that are not used to seeing protests. Hundreds marched through downtown Gillette last week demanding justice for Floyd and Black Americans killed by police violence. Residents of smaller cities like Rock Springs and Riverton didn't have to travel to make their voices heard. Demonstrations there also drew hundreds of people. At a protest in Lander, protesters called for an end to white supremacy.
Hey, hey, ho, ho! These racist people got to go! Hey, hey, ho, ho! These racist people got to go! Hey,
even
hey,
small towns like Dubois and Pinedale saw small Black Lives Matter demonstrations. To start off the program today, Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr brings you the voices of Black Wyomingites who have been out protesting.
There's been a lot of silence in Wyoming surrounding the death of George Floyd, and for me as a Black individual, a Black soul, I feel real discomfort with it.
Forest Parks was pleasantly surprised to see more than 100 people come out to a vigil in Riverton on June 1st.
I also have some mixed feelings with the space on just the fact that we are surrounded by white supremacy, and folks who know who I am and see me may know where I live, may know where I work, and that terrifies me to be at an event like this and not know who's going to continue to show up.
Another demonstrator in Riverton took the mic after organizers asked Black community members to come up and speak. She addressed the white people in the crowd directly.
I really want you to think about your grandparents and your parents and your uncles and your aunts who don't want to be here, who don't have to think about anything like police violence, because when they break the law, they get a pass. Every day I have to think about my loved ones, my little brother, if he'll make it past the age of 10, 12, 13, 14, because of the way he looks and because of the way that we continue to allow this world to disrespect Black people.
Across our state, young Black Wyomingites have been part of the conversation. At a rally in Casper, 15-year-old Maishla Bovey asked the crowd what took them so long to take a stand against police violence.
Why is it that it takes a death for us to stand up? That's outrageous. And all the protests that are happening, we see police officers using tear gas and rubber bullets bigger than my hand. That's outrageous. Where's the unity? George Floyd has a daughter. Her name is Gianna. She will never get to see her father ever again. That's outrageous. We're taking our fathers away from children. We're taking children away from their mothers. If you aren't angry, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
In Lander, 19-year-old Akai Grable was among several young people from the Wind River Reservation who helped lead a demonstration. He said this was his first time being part of a protest.
This is definitely something I want to stand for, being that I'm mixed too. I'm Native and I'm Black. So, you know, any way I can, you know, especially it being in my own, you know, town.
Grable said he knows many of his friends and neighbors don't agree with him on issues of racial justice.
I have a couple people who I know in my social group that think that this is not the way to go. And so I'm glad to see that, you know, if people my age can come around to Black Lives Matter issues.
The Lander demonstration drew a small number of armed counter-protesters. One young man at that event spoke about how it felt to see white men carrying long guns and sledgehammers on the other side of the street.
I could be George Floyd. I've been in situations like that because I'm Black, because someone fears, because I'm stereotyped as a hoodlum or thug. When I sat there and watched the video of George Floyd being killed, that hurt me. Because what are they gonna tell my son when his dad doesn't come home? If you sit back and be silent and do nothing, you're no better than the person kneeling on his neck.
In Laramie, James Henry spoke about seeing his white neighbors stand up against racism after decades of silence.
The thing about working on a job and being treated racist, man, you don't have nobody to stick up for you. You know what I'm saying? You don't have nobody to back you up. They see it, they hear it, but, you know, they too scared to back you up. This is why I came out. These beautiful people are speaking up.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
Staying with the same theme, Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reported from several nights of the protests in Laramie and brings us the voices of some of the young Black Wyomingites leading those marches.
I'm so thankful I don't have to stand out here with a handful of people. I got about 30 handfuls of people.
At least from my perspective, I didn't expect this. I didn't expect this amount of strength and power from this tiny town that is notorious for everyone.
I know y'all can hear me. I am biracial, but I'm here today to represent every piece and percent of melanin in my body all today, and for each person laying here all today.
I remember the first time that I had to have a conversation with my dad about being stopped by the police. I was in 9th grade. It was right after Trayvon Martin happened. And just the fact that I realized, you know, this is so wrong, this is so unjust, and I was angry. Not only angry, but terrified of my life.
Yeah, when you're the only, like, person of color in a 300-person lecture hall, or when you're the only Black person you see in Walmart, you know, it's just something that you become aware of, and you get looks, and you get questions that are strange, and you live through the motions of microaggressions and macroaggressions.
History is being made on today, and y'all have no idea how much, even though I'm as hurt as I am right now, my heart is smiling. My heart is smiling. My heart is smiling. My heart is smiling for every one of you today.
And I think that a lot of people that are against us think that we're fighting their rights, but really we're fighting their privilege. And that's hard to lose, I understand. I wouldn't want to lose my privilege either, but I would much rather fight for equality and have a few people lose a few privileges than keep this system that we have and have a lot of people losing their lives.
Right now, because white people are upset, doesn't mean that this is just now a problem or this is the time we should be outraged. You all should have been mad when Trayvon Martin was killed 8 years ago. And you should have rage in your hearts every single day that this is happening.
something's different. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the moons in line. I'm just glad that people like finally see the light, because it's like, this is what we've been seeing and like screaming for centuries. And you know, I'm pissed off that it took centuries, but I'm so thankful that we're seeing it now.
Educate yourself, ask for Black voices, listen to them, but also do your own work. Have your own conversations, start them.
That was Timberly Vogel, Ashley McDowell, and Jabon Garcia in Laramie. When we come back, there are some who are opposing the movement. We will hear from them next on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Black Lives Matter protests have picked up steam across Wyoming as citizens speak out against pervasive police violence and systemic racism against Black people. A near constant presence at the events, though, have been small bands of gun-wielding counter-protesters. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports, and a warning, this story contains racist language.
Black Lives Matter protesters stand at a busy intersection in Laramie. They're chanting as a red pickup comes towards them, driving down the wrong side of the road. A young white man stands in the bed holding a large Trump 2020 flag. Several protesters attempt to block it, but the truck moves forward slowly and hits them, pushing them backwards. One protester thought they were about to witness a murder. The Laramie Police Department is now investigating the incident. Gun-toting, pro-Trump counter-protests have become part of the Black Lives Matter story in communities across Wyoming. In Gillette, at one march, trucks drove past protesters repeatedly revving their engines and blowing exhaust, a common tactic amongst counter-protesters. Later, police officers had to stand between the two sides. Counter-protesters waved American and Trump flags at the other side, yelling. At one point, a white woman yells the N-word at a woman of color. The groups around the state don't claim to be organized. A few in Gillette mentioned they were part of the anti-government militia 3%ers, but otherwise, nothing. Many say they want to keep the peace. That was the case in Lander, where vigilantes stood in front of Jenny Reeves Johnson's business. Several held assault rifles, another a sledgehammer, swinging it occasionally. Reeves Johnson says she didn't feel safe enough to even enter her own business.
It was life-changing for me to be in front of people with guns like that. Then the next day, finding out that they were there to protect my business, I got angry instead of scared. I got amazingly angry. I just thought, what?
In Laramie, the counter-protesters are well-known for driving past the march each day, revving engines, and having held assault rifles in the back of a truck. One even pulled a gun in an altercation about driving on the right side of the road, where both sides got pretty heated.
Let's go.
Get in your truck and go. Get in your gun and go.
What are we doing? Are you?
The siren, nor the voice, by the way, is a cop, but a protester. A staging ground for counter-protesters is at the old Kmart parking lot. A group of 10 or so white people are gathered, saying they're just a group of friends with no formal affiliation. And like the counter-protesters in Lander, they say they're there for protection. Cody Buzell leans on his motorcycle.
They wanted a peaceful protest, and to me, a peaceful protest is them staying on the sidewalk, staying out on the street. So right there, that made us even more angry.
Buzell says he's very patriotic and feels Black Lives Matter protesters are disrespecting the flag.
They're flying it upside down.
Yeah.
That right there hits hard on home.
Matthew Davis says their group has been spit at and flipped off, that they have a right to be out there too. They acknowledge their presence is intimidating.
Yes.
They all see it as threatening.
Everybody
every one
does.
Of them.
They have every right to be scared.
But you still want to carry it.
Look at the big picture, yeah. Man. There's 1,000 people at this thing. And there's maybe 30 of us.
Down the road from the old Kmart, hundreds of protesters are in the street, making their way up Grand Avenue, though police have urged them to stay on sidewalks. All of a sudden, a young white man in his work clothes jumps out of his truck next to the march and starts screaming at protesters.
God, country, and you guys are going to be disrespectful like that?
Dude, you guys, you're wearing a f***ing flag on your f***ing face. You.
Come on, keep
f***ing. You and this peace protest.
Lead organizer for the Black Lives Matter March, Timberly Bogle, watched the whole thing unfold.
We're inhibiting traffic, the flow, for a few minutes, and there's also like 20 other blocks in this town. But that's what gets scary, you know, when people are so upset at seeing a demonstration of democracy where they will get out and verbally abuse someone.
Bogle says it's clear counter-protesters are looking to intimidate, but it actually comes off as them being scared.
A peaceful protest to be met with AR-15s, I mean signs versus guns, I know that they are scared and uncomfortable. They're trying to show their strength and a sign of force because they feel that their power is threatened. And so I'm really glad that they feel that because I want to threaten their power.
Not personally, she says, but the system of power. Vogel says the All Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter slogans miss the mark.
It's just really sort of skewed the point of Black Lives Matter because it wasn't ever that any other lives don't matter. I mean, where it was to highlight a disproportionate amount of injustices being done towards brown and black bodies, and so.
Black people are more than twice as likely to be killed than white people by cops, according to the research and advocacy organization Mapping Police Violence. Vogel says the fact that there's so much opposition to the Black Lives Matter movement shows these marches just need to continue. And that's the plan. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
As the protest erupted, some law enforcement officials have come out speaking against the way George Floyd was killed. Cody Police Chief Chuck Baker released a joint statement with the Powell Police and Park County Sheriff's Departments, describing themselves as appalled by the use of force. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska sat down with the Cody Police Chief to hear what he learned from being present at a recent rally.
Well, there's certainly a lot of concern about the equality in law enforcement. There's a lot of concern about brutality in law enforcement. There's a lot of concern about, people dying at the hands of law enforcement. So, I think it's all of that information is very important as a starting point for me to understand the community. One of the things that I've always said is that you have to align your services and your policing philosophy with the desires of your community.
Are police receiving training on handling conflicts with diverse groups of people, whether that's people of color or people with mental health issues, for instance?
Well, one of the things is most recently, we've had a lot of focus on our training related to dealing with people that are in crisis, mental health issues, developmental disabilities, and conditions that cause people to act erratically and threateningly. The other piece is dealing with armed encounters with people other than firearms. So we've really focused on those two components most recently. We've also included into our training a component of de-escalation. Right now we're in the process of reviewing all policies and procedures. We have recently implemented some new policy, and we're going to continue to review those policies, particularly with our internal affairs investigation process, the review of use of force, the review of police pursuits, all of those reviews of critical police actions.
And what about training regarding encounters with people of color in the state?
That's quite honestly is one of the things that is lacking in our organization. And I've talked about that in my piece. That is one of the components that we need to do better at. And the other thing is, you know, police officers do not like to be called racist. But the point I was making at the rally was that racism comes in other forms other than racists. And in law enforcement, we have allowed some of these cultures, and we have categorized or stereotyped groups of people in certain ways that makes us act and treat those people differently. And so the culture of organizations is very critical at the law enforcement leadership side to monitor, manage, and ensure you have an appropriate culture. But we can do better with training.
Can you go into a little bit more specifics about the culture that you were talking about, of like how to instill that culture in the police force?
So you don't want to have a culture of us versus them. You want to have a community collaborative culture in your organization where the community works with the law enforcement to ensure that the law enforcement aligns with the community expectations. And so there's a lot of familiarity. And again, knowing that your chief of police will take action if there is an inappropriate incident that occurs within the organization within your jurisdiction is very important. The other thing that's very important is this, particularly in this event, is the duty to intervene. You know, the one thing that I have to instill as it relates to culture is that we have to hold ourselves accountable, because if we don't, organizations and people are going to come in and hold us accountable, and maybe to a different standard that is inappropriate for law enforcement. But the point is that internally we have to hold ourselves accountable. And I have to rely on my officers that at 3 o'clock in the morning, when three of them are dealing with an incident and one of them sees something that is not in line with our values, not in line with our policies or procedures, they step back, they take action, they intervene. That's the one thing that I saw in this that really made me very angry about the profession. You gotta hold yourselves accountable. You have to have a very strong culture of accountability.
And so you mentioned that there's not enough training, or there hasn't been enough in the past, about handling conflicts with people of color. And nationally right now, there seems to be police departments that are trying to make changes and taking actions because of this event. And I wonder if you are thinking of taking any actions.
The one thing is, and again, that was why I was there. I was listening to people, and that's something that I can construe from what I heard and what I saw, is that the way that we interact with people. And so I think it's important that will be something that I will evaluate within our training curriculum as we go forward. I do know that in Wyoming, it's included to a certain degree within our academy trainings. But what we need to have is ongoing training and continuing training in the organization in our regular in-service training. So what that is, what that looks like, how it fits, you know, Cody Police Department and this region will be determined.
Thank you so much, Chief Baker.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
In a moment, we will change gears and hear why Senator Barrasso has some concerns about a popular piece of legislation, and some are nervous about where Wyoming is heading when it comes to COVID-19. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's U.S. senators spent the week fighting a bill that would permanently fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund, along with money for a portion of the maintenance backlog at national parks all across the nation. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund was passed more than 50 years ago. It takes offshore oil and gas revenue and invests it in local communities, some of which are spread across Wyoming. Senator John Barrasso says it's made an impact at home.
Rodeo grounds in Meteetse, a shooting range in Lusk, some softball and baseball fields. So over the years, it's done a number of very good things for Wyoming. There's a long history of success of the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
But this year, funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund was combined with a bill aimed at tackling the backlog of maintenance at national parks. The final package, which the Senate's been debating this week, is called the Great American Outdoors Act. And the combination of the two is where Barrasso gets cold feet.
Well, you know, I'm a supporter of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, but I have a couple of concerns about this Great American Outdoors Act.
Barrasso's a GOP leader. But even his efforts to amend the bill were rebuffed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. A few hours ahead of the vote on Thursday, even Barrasso told us he didn't like it.
Washington will be given authority to buy more private land in Wyoming, and I don't think that's the right approach. We can't afford to maintain the public lands that we have right now. The other concern I have is that it doesn't provide a long-term fix to address the deferred maintenance backlog that we have at our national parks. And number three, the concern is this is mandatory spending like Medicare or Social Security, and it's permanent.
Wyoming senators are in the minority. Republican Senator Cory Gardner from neighboring Colorado is pushing the effort. He says setting up a permanent funding mechanism for the Land and Water Fund is vital.
Throughout the past 55 years, though, dollars have been diverted away from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. What this legislation does through its permanent funding is make sure that the dollars that we have authorized beginning in 1965, make sure that that doesn't get diverted, make sure that it stops being siphoned off.
Gardner's up for re-election, though he denies he's pushing this proposal for electoral gain. He says it makes fiscal sense.
This is money that's paid for. This is paid for not by the taxpayers. This is paid for by oil and gas revenues. These dollars are generated from the revenues that come from offshore. Those energy revenues, a boat tax, excise tax, boat fuel excise tax, a couple of other things. But it's not coming out of the taxpayers.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi disagrees. He offered an amendment that would require a new fee, or tax, on the more than 14 million foreigners who visit the nation's parks annually.
Foreign visitors to the Taj Mahal in India will pay an $18 fee, compared to a fee of only 56 cents for local visitors. At Kruger National Park in South Africa, visitors from outside the country will pay $25 per day, compared to $6.25 for local visitors. Many European countries like Spain, France, and Italy charge a tourist tax on hotel rooms that's used to pay for tourism infrastructure.
Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander says after about 60 years of trying, it's time for Congress to fully fund these land and water conservation projects.
This is our one chance to get this kind of funding to make our national parks and all the rest of our public lands, the boat ramps, the trails, the roads, the sewage, our one chance to begin to fix the maintenance over a five-year period of time instead of 10, 15, 25 years or never. It's our one chance to do that. And I'm sure it's our one chance to get the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanently funded as Congress agreed to do in 1964.
But Senator Barrasso brushes aside that perspective, even if it's from a senior member of his own party. He says the legislation enables Washington lawmakers to scoop up more Western lands at a time they can't even pay for the ones they have. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Following more than a month of shuttered businesses and strict social distancing measures, the state began to reopen in May. That shift has been accompanied by a marked increase in COVID-19-related deaths. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports that public health experts are saying that the two are likely related.
The COVID-19 epidemic has grown worse in Wyoming since the state started loosening restrictions last month. Deaths attributed to the virus more than doubled during the last 2 weeks of May, though they have so far slowed in June.
There's no question that with people, both by their own decisions and by policy, emerging from staying at home, the cases do appear to be increasing.
That's University of Wyoming researcher Christine Porter. She says it's difficult to see trends in a state with such a small population, but a spike in deaths 2 weeks after reopening is not surprising.
You know, you get infected, on average, it's about 5 days later that you start to show symptoms, and about a week to 2 weeks later, if you're going to die, you die.
Since the relaxation of social distancing measures, some have gone back to their normal behaviors. But Porter says the threat of a large outbreak is still very real. She says everyone should act as though they're infected.
As many as 80% of people who end up infected and can be spreading it have mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. And about half of cases are transmitted before anybody has symptoms. You cannot rely on symptoms.
Porter says wearing a mask in public is a good way to protect those around you.
So people who are now wearing masks out are risking infecting other people because they could be infected and they don't know it. It's very irresponsible, and it's kind of like manslaughter. If you unintentionally infect somebody and they end up dying of it, or they spread it to somebody who then dies, it's not on purpose, but that is the result.
Dr. Mark Dowell is an infectious disease specialist in Casper. He agrees that people should be wearing masks.
No one's going to ask you to wear a mask when you're walking the dog, but when you're going into the grocery store or when you're getting your hair cut and those kind of places.
In fact, he says wearing a mask is now more important than ever as people in Wyoming start to have more personal interactions.
But unfortunately, we went from people doing a fairly good job of social distancing and wearing a face covering to basically, if you want to be blunt about it, blowing it off. And there didn't seem to be anything in between.
And because of that, there are concerns about what comes next. He says wearing a mask or avoiding crowds will come down to personal responsibility.
You can close rodeos and you can close these huge gatherings, and that's what should be done right now. But when it comes down to the nuts and bolts within a given community, if it's not enforced, at least psychologically in the community, it's not going to happen anymore.
Experts are concerned cases and deaths will go up. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has been modeling the projected rise of COVID-19 cases and deaths. The continuously updated model now predicts that Wyoming will see 99 deaths from the pandemic by October. Because of the state's low population, that projection carries a wide margin of error, with a high bar of nearly 1,000 deaths by October. Dr. Ali Mokhtad is the Chief Strategy Officer for Population Health for the University of Washington. He says the projections depend in part on personal behavior.
Right now, if you look at Wyoming and every state, as they are relaxing the social distancing measures and people are going out and about, then you'll increase circulation of the virus and it'll start coming up.
Wyoming is now in the process of figuring out how to reopen schools and campuses in the fall, and Mokhtad is expecting some challenges.
All these models right now are agreeing on one simple thing, that this is a deadly virus. It's going to come back again in the fall, and we have to be ready for it.
The likely resurgence of the virus and the probable lack of a vaccine means that testing, contact tracing, monitoring, and self-quarantine will be even more important in the fall. Mokhtad says a pulse method might be the way forward. That means entering short periods of lockdown whenever COVID starts to flare up, shutting down and reopening repeatedly rather than locking down for a longer, indefinite period of time. It involves taking the pulse of the pandemic and the population to determine when those shorter lockdowns are implemented.
A major issue for many governors and many states is, what do you do in September when the numbers are going up in terms of infections and mortality?
Porter says that truly returning to life before the pandemic is only possible with a vaccine. Until one is developed, she says Wyoming residents need to keep up the habits that have kept the state relatively safe so far. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Governor Mark Gordon and leaders from some of the top rodeos in the state this month announced that the major events would be canceled this year. That's due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the health safety measures that would have had to be put in place for those events. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Billy Kraft and Zane Garstead, who head up the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo. First, Kraft explains why they came to the decision to put the 90th anniversary celebration on hold.
This decision was arrived at very painfully, and after a tremendous amount of discussion and looking at options and alternatives, not just with ourselves, but with a statewide group, with our county and state health officials, the governor's office, and the six rodeos that worked together to make this decision. And we've been at this for 6 weeks. We tried every way we could think of to try to make something work. And there's just not a box or a bottle that you can put this situation in that will float. It just won't work. And we want to make sure that people understand that nobody made us do this.
This is obviously a really important weekend to Sheridan. How are you feeling about the effects it will have down the line for local businesses this summer?
It's really tough to make a call like this when this is without a doubt the single biggest week in the Sheridan economy. It's a big deal, and we don't know exactly what it is, but we know it's somewhere north of $6 million for the community. We felt the potential risk, the long-term risk to the economy by going forward with the event and then risking a spike in the disease, which then shut everything down for an undetermined period of time, be it another 2 months, 6 months, another 10 or 12, it would bankrupt Main Street. So we think in the long term, we're better off to take this short-term hit and continue our reopening process than we were to try to move forward and risk shutting the whole thing down.
Because the spirit of the event would have been impacted by the restrictions you would have had to put in place, like masks and social distancing. It just changes the nature of it. And so did that also factor into your group decision on that?
You don't go to something like this by yourself. A few people may, but a very few. You go with family, you go with friends, you go with loved ones, whatever. And to go experience that when you have to be separated from them, and even if you could sit six or seven together, it's still not the same, because it's the social event for the community. Whether it's Cheyenne, Sheridan, Cody, it doesn't make any difference. People get together, and a lot of them, that's the only time they'll see each other all summer. To think that we could produce an event and implement the social distancing directives and requirements that were handed down and still have people experience a positive week or an hour, whatever it was they took part in, it couldn't happen. It was not going to be the same.
And Zane, I mean, also did that play into, you know, thinking about vendors or people that work or volunteer for the rodeo?
We couldn't have half a rodeo, half an event. You can't have an event. We have the parade. We have the carnival. We have street dances, the powwow. We have, you know, our gold buckle booster club thing. There's 750 people in one area. And you start taking those things away, and then you say, who has to stay away? We have to have half the vendors that we usually do. So we were in a no-win situation. It was better that we probably said no rodeo at all than to jeopardize our relationships with the people that we work with year in and year out.
And so obviously there are still limits about what we can all do in public or what's open, things like that. Are you planning on doing anything in lieu of the rodeo, or, you know, having some sort of event, doing something to fill that week or a day?
I think there's a lot of potential for that. And I think as we've come to understand that we all need each other, that we even get together with city and county officials and travel and tourism, and we have a meeting and just say, hey, what could we do? What could we do with the, you know, the restrictions that we have on group sizes? But there's things out there, and people are entrepreneurs, and you know that people are going to figure out something to do, and thank goodness for that.
If there's a silver lining in this thing, And it's really hard to call it a silver lining. But if there's a positive note to this, it's the relationships that have been built through this process of trying to figure out how to deal with it. We've never had a Wyoming pro-rodeo coalition before. I mean, there's some good things that will come in the future because of what started here.
That was Billy Kraft and Zane Garstead, who head the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo. They were speaking with Catherine Wheeler. Since the governor's initial announcement, the Cody Stampede has decided to still hold their rodeo with restrictions from the state health officer. Coming up, a conversation with that state health officer, Alexia Harris. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In early 2020, very few people had ever heard of Dr. Alexia Harris. Since that time, the state health officer has become a well-known and important figure in the state as she tries to guide the state through COVID-19. Dr. Harris has lately been opening things up. She joins me to assess where we are and what's to come. Dr. Harris, first off, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us. Let's start with just the new orders. We're continuing to loosen things in the state. Are you comfortable that we can try and do some more things in Wyoming without a lot of risk?
So I am. I think that we've been doing a great job really since the start of the pandemic, taking social distancing very seriously. And it's because of that we have been successful in keeping our case counts relatively low. And of course, our deaths relatively low. I certainly hate to see that 18 people have died from COVID-19, but we do know that it could have been many more than that. And so as we're seeing some of our numbers stabilize, including the number of new cases per day, we're seeing our percent, the percent of our tests that are testing positive drop pretty steadily, which is an indication that we're doing a sufficient amount of testing to detect the cases that are here in Wyoming. We do have some ability to ease restrictions, allow more types of activities, but it's also really important to that people still take social distancing and face coverings seriously as we are able to do more activities. And so these larger activities, especially that are allowed in the new orders, I think are provide some ability to undertake some really important activities for our communities, like rodeos, like parades. But the social distancing within those types of events is going to remain important for a while to come.
So one of the things I'm noticing, and maybe it's been the warm weather with the exception of Laramie on what it was, Monday or Tuesday, but
right.
with that aside, that ugly memory, it does seem like a lot of people that I see seem to think, wow, hey, we survived COVID-19. This is great. Let's just move on with our lives. How much does that concern you?
So it is definitely concerning. You know, there was a theory early on in the pandemic that potentially we would see a slowdown of transmission during the summer months, because sometimes we do see that with respiratory viruses like influenza, for example. I would just have people note that we are continuing to identify cases at a steady rate. In some cases, we're identifying them in geographic areas where we hadn't seen cases for a while. And so I don't think that the virus is going to go away this summer. I think we're going to continue to identify new cases, and that precautions are still going to be important.
Have you noticed a consistent way people are getting this, or a consistency in the type of people that are testing positive?
I would say that there's a wide variety of ways that people are being exposed. And, you know, it just really shows that really anybody can get this virus and transmit it onto others. Of course, you know, we are seeing the outbreaks in communal settings like nursing homes and assisted living facilities, which we've reported on. And we also have seen some healthcare worker infections, which you do expect in these types of pandemics and have been reported from other places. But really, you know, people who don't have those types of specific exposures are getting COVID-19, transmitting it within their households or within small groups, you know, relate in workplaces or at family events. And so I think it's a indicator that even people who don't think that they might have specific exposures are still at risk and that precautions are important.
Dr. Alexia Harris, your state health officer, visiting with us. So that leads to, here we are, tourist season. Nobody wants to fly. They're probably going to drive to places like Wyoming. What should we be concerned about there, and how prepared are we to handle something that might blow up because of tourists?
That's a very good question, and tourism is so important for us, and as well, you know, that we want people to come see our great state because that's what it is. We have secured some extra testing capacity for areas like Teton County and Park County, where we do expect a lot of tourism because of the national parks there, testing that can be used both to make sure we have enough tests to diagnose ill people who may come or ill people within the community, as well as to do some enhanced surveillance in those communities to make sure that we are detecting cases early and can implement the control measures that we know to be effective in terms of contact tracing, isolation, and quarantine. So I do think we are prepared. It certainly is a concern. And in those areas, as throughout the state of Wyoming, trying to social distance as much as possible, wearing face coverings are important measures to take.
I want to ask you about a couple of things before we let you go. University of Wyoming and other schools thinking about how this might look. I don't know if you've consulted with UW on its plan, but how does that look to you? And do you think there is a good opportunity to open up this year?
Sure. So I did have the opportunity to review the university's plan. I appreciate, you know, they're sending it to us to review and all the work that went into it. I think it takes into account everything that's important in ensuring that we slow transmission and reduce transmission as much as possible in terms of, again, social distancing, mask use, having a plan for testing and control measures if there are cases identified on campus. I feel that education and, you know, it is an extremely important part of our communities. We need our children to be educated. It's really an essential function. And so I do have high hopes that we can open the schools. That is one thing that the new orders did, and that we can have in-person classes in the fall. I think that is something that we need to really work towards.
And how would that look? What's going to be the best way to do that?
Also a good question, and it of course depends on how the outbreak in Wyoming looks at the time. I think that, you know, measures to reduce you know, exposures to large groups of people as much as possible are important. So there may be maybe strategies to limit, you know, mixing between different groups of students so that if there is a positive case, you're limiting the number of people potentially exposed. Schools will have to, you know, have some flexibility in terms of if we do identify a case or an outbreak, we may have to take more stringent measures for a while until we get a handle of what's going on and ensuring that proper measures are in place to prevent further transmission. But I do think that there are workable solutions. I know the schools have been really working hard on planning for what that looks like. There's a statewide working group looking at how K-12 schools can operate in a way that's both safe but provides the essential services that the kids need.
I assume the Mountain West Conference will have a lot to say about this, but do you anticipate Wyoming football with fans in the stands?
So I do. How exactly it's going to look is still, there are still lots of discussions about that, and absolutely, you know, the conference will have a role in that. My hope is certainly that we can have football and that we can have at least some spectators in the stands.
Dr. Harris, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your efforts in keeping the state safe.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. This program and individual segments are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find stories on the station Facebook page. Never miss an episode by signing up for our Open Spaces podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. This high-quality news program isn't free. Please support the program with your donation on our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.